I'm Tony Rango. For those of you who came to the session yesterday on risk management, I run the Sierra Club's Outdoor Adventure Travel Program. I've been coming to the conference for about 6 or 7 years and working with Mara to kind of bring more risk management type topics to ETC. We have a couple other folks who are joining us from yesterday as well.
Good morning. I'm Rod Gould. I'm an attorney in Massachusetts, delighted to be with you guys.
And my name is Kathy Hansen Stamp, and I'm an attorney from Golden, Colorado, licensed in Wyoming and Colorado, and I'm excited to be here with all of you and to learn from you, too.
Good morning. My name is Aaliyah Cott. I'm Assistant Vice President for International Education at the University of New Orleans, and primarily my job involves study abroad and exchanges. So I'm coming from that perspective, although a lot of what we'll be talking about, I think, is applicable in any kind of travel situation.
Great. And if you guys have questions, feel free to stop, and I'm going to hand you the mic as we do that, just so that I can get recorded and your voice is on there and not kind of in the distance. So just, you know, raise your hand. We'll pass. We have another mic, too, if we need it, if it gets, you know, a lot of interest in things and we want to, you know, be talking back and forth. First off, you know, we talked yesterday, for those of you who attended, about incidents, and we had some case studies on incidents. We did make reference to safety management planning and incident reporting. Incident reporting tends to come after an incident, as Rod talked about. It's an objective analysis of what happened rather than admitting who did what and who was at fault and things like that. Safety management planning is kind of on the front end of things when you're preparing for your trip and heading into the field. It's a way to document all the things that you might need at your fingertips, because in the middle of an emergency or an incident, the last thing you want to be doing is trying to find all the different pieces of paperwork or making phone calls to try and get the numbers you might need or the information you might need, because a lot of times time is of the essence and it's critical, and the time wasted on that could be spent on giving care or evacuating someone. So a lot goes in, you know, for our program, we spend a lot of time of the safety management planning. We required on all our trips for the leaders to develop a safety management plan to take into the field so they have everything they need, and they also give us a copy so when they call me, I can pull that out and we can be on the same page talking through the evacuation or what the needs are. I know maybe exactly where they are. If I need to reach them, I have that information as well, numbers and information. So it's kind of a critical document for us, and I'll give a little story about why it became even more critical and stuff in the field. It's a sample form that you see. Everyone has a copy, right? So this is a sample form we use for our international trips. We have a different one for domestic. This one obviously has a lot more about hotels and logistics, and the itineraries are a little bit longer for international. So we have a separate form for our international domestic. But essentially, it's going to capture the same kind of information. You want to know details about the trip, where you're going to be staying each day, information about your passengers or participants, emergency contact information. Those things are really critical, if somebody dies on your trip and you really need that information quickly to get some word out. Other specifics, and this is, again, just a concept for you to take back and say, well, I need this piece here, I want this piece, and I want to add these things in for my program. You know, we run things a little bit differently, and so she may have some different information than we have in our form. But again, it's more of just an idea for you to get to thinking about sort of what your ideal form may be and whether you use multiple forms for your own programs. So that's kind of the first step, is sort of the preparation. It also gets my leaders, thinking about what are potential hazards that they might encounter. So whether it's going to be snakes or lions or tigers or polar bears or whatever it may be that could be a potential hazard, cliff, you know, or altitude. And then what are the kind of the mitigation steps that we might be taking to address that? So they're thinking about that ahead of time. So when it comes up, it's like, oh my God, what do I do? I've kind of already thought through some of those problems that could come up that we could be addressing. So we ask them to identify, and that first page you'll see some of the risks and hazards of the program. Come on in, we got some sample form for you. Join our circle. Yep, over there. So, you know, these folks here can maybe talk about the legal reasons why we would want something and how this might help you if something were to happen in event of a lawsuit. You know, what type of information that, you know, would be useful as part of that process to help in your own case, because that you've done that proper planning and preparation for your trip. So what I plan to do at some point, you know, when we get to, we'll kind of go through the different aspects of the forum, let you guys ask questions along the way, and then we'll, Aaliyah's going to talk a little about what she includes in her information, and as she'll pass that out. But we also try and have a little checklist on the back as you see that. We also have contact numbers of for me or the program chairs if they need to get a hold of them. So a variety of things like that that we include in our forum, so that kind of it's everything's there at their fingertips at the same time. So the incident I had was about 4 or 5 years ago. We had a polar bear attack. And so the participant was pretty severely wounded. The leaders had, we had just kind of started requiring safety management plans as part of this process of our program. And the feedback we got was it was completely invaluable to have that, because obviously it was a critical situation, lots of blood, lots of things going on. And having the contact numbers both for me as well as the evacuation services was something that we really felt was critical. Yeah, maybe we could push back a little bit and expand. I know we kind of grew and stuff, so get our bigger circle going here. Yeah, we can. Everyone need a handout here? You got one? One for you, all right, extras. So that's kind of the framework in which we operate of why we do safety management planning. Maybe I'll let these guys talk about some legal thoughts on that before we jump into the actual forum about how that might be important. I'll pass the mic to Rod and Kathy and let them kind of share about that.
Okay, I wanted to just spend a minute on one issue. Normally, we require, we meaning tour operators, you know, universities, a fair amount of medical information. And I've seen sheets that basically it's like a comprehensive analysis of everything that has ever happened to the person from birth to the date they sign it. I mean, I've seen 2-3 pages worth. I mean, I've also seen one sentence ones, and tell us of any medical conditions that may impact your ability to do the trip or enjoy the trip. So there's a couple of thoughts. The first and the most important is that it may be great to have all measure of medical information, and it may be necessary in an emergency. But the critical point is that it be there. It's not enough that the medical information is sitting in a safe somewhere at the university's office and the trip is in Nepal. Whoever is leading the trip in Nepal has to have it. The worst thing that can happen is that you get something from Mr. Jones. I'm allergic to XYZ, whatever XYZ is. And you don't do anything with it. So he's now over in Nepal, and something happens, and the medical crew gives him XYZ, and he dies. That's a nightmare of a disaster. That's the first and the most important thing by far. Now, there's privacy issues that come into play, and I'll come to that in just a second. But the second point is, what do you really need? And literally, I've seen forms that say, have you ever been hospitalized? Have you ever had surgery? Have you ever seen a doctor? Well, do you really need all of this? I mean, you know, somebody has an appendicitis at age 12 and he's now 65. Do you care? Do you want that information? Especially in light of, you know, there's a remote privacy issue. Don't ask for things you don't need. What you really want is, and you can make a subset of it, is do you have any physical or mental condition that would prevent you or hinder you in completing all of the trip events and enjoying them. That's what you really want to know. Look, if they do have some problem and they don't tell you, one, it's their fault, and two, you can always throw them out if they can't do the trip. So be careful what you ask for. It's an old expression, but be careful what you ask for. You may get it. And you don't want so much that you can't do anything with it. All right, so, and the third thing, and then I'll pass the mic over. There's a tension between privacy and the medical information. I think sometimes that's overblown. I think sometimes universities have been hammered so much with HIPAA and FERPA and privacy acts and Title VII and everything else that there's a certain almost paranoia that sometimes sets in. University is running a trip. ABC Tour Company is the tour operator. Does the university even need the medical information? Or is it enough to give it to the tour operator who then gives it to the local ground handler? And I raise the question. There may be reasons why the university needs it. But again, with the privacy stuff, the fewer people that have it, the better. And if both the university and the tour operator are going to get it, state that. This stuff can be waived. You can waive your privacy rights. You just make it clear, and you can waive it. I mean, for example, student trips, which I don't want to bang away too much on student trips. We did that yesterday. But you can put in the contract that I agree to waive my privacy rights. I allow the tour operator or the university to talk to my parents about anything related to my trip abroad. You can do that. You know, whether you want to do it or not is a different question. It depends on the facts. If there's a serious injury, yeah, you may want to do it. You know, if there's a very minor disciplinary problem, you may not want to do it. But you can do it. And it's the same thing with the health information. If multiple people are going to get it, make sure they know and that they've agreed to it. If they don't agree to disseminate it to anybody we think is necessary to disseminate it to it, they can go on somebody else's trip. So, I mean, that's a couple of thoughts on those issues. I'll pass the mic.
Hi, so Tony, I'm going to ask you this because you know these terms better than I do, but as I was preparing for this session, I realize that all of you may be in kind of different categories. You're not all hosts. Some of you may be tour operators. Some of you may even be in-country. Rod calls it ground handlers or ground operators. So I'm curious, can you get a show of hands of who we have here? Who do we have?
How many
planners? Planners. Would that be a host? Planner. The host. Travel planners. How about U.S. tour operators? Okay, any ground? Okay, so we've got all folks. So from my perspective and all of our perspective, as you look at these safety management plans or whatever you call them, the briefing that you or your staff get, it will be slightly different, right, depending on what hat you're wearing out there in the field. So keep that in mind. Our comments may resonate more with one group of you than another, but you'll sort of be thinking about your role if we're talking more about like the host, or we're talking about the U.S. operator. One thing I wanted to say is that when I speak to people in this field, so because I work with people or organizations that provide recreation and adventure and experiential services to the public, so that could include people like you, or it could include a camp, or a school, private school that does a lot of international travel, or something like that. The focus that I have as an attorney is not on necessarily keeping you out of court or focusing on, keeping you from getting sued, which as Rod knows we can't do, but on running the endeavor to run a quality program. And when you do that, you're going to address the legal issues because that's part of running a quality program, okay? We do talk about lawsuits, and in fact, Hotchkiss, anybody remember that case? 2 days ago, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. I was working on one of the amicus briefs, very discouraging, $41.5 million verdict. Those are serious things happening out there, but we talk about those. But what we want to talk about first is how these things roll out. And you know, your basic duty of care, which is the duty to exercise reasonable care, whatever hat you're wearing, in the U.S. in any event. And so if you want to try and think of legal issues in a compartmentalized way and say, oh, I've got a waiver of liability, I've dealt with legal, now I can move on to something else. What I think you need to know is picture a sea sponge, underwater sea sponge, right? It's a sponge. It gets its nutrients from the water. The water's flowing in and out. Legal is going to be like the water, and your program is the sea sponge. It's flowing in and out of every aspect of your program. Depending on what happens, whether it, you know, is a plane that goes down, as we saw in this most recent issue, or it is a trip leader who makes a judgment miscalculation, or it's an operator who makes a mistake or whatever. If it's, you know, if we're looking at the duty of care, it's going to typically be, in the U.S., there are other duties, but typically the duty to exercise reasonable care. So I wanted to just say that. And I think when you're looking at, like, the safety management plan, if whatever hat you're wearing, you want to think about, you know, it from a practical perspective and have that sense of, okay, so I've got all this list. What does this mean to me, right? What is it going to mean if we do have an emergency? What are some typical scenarios? I mean, when we talk about you wanting to be in touch with the CDC, the State Department, get your students signed up with a STEP program, do whatever in-country vetting, perhaps through the ground partner, if you're the host or you're the U.S. operator, you're trying to understand, like, what's out there for us. Even the other one that I think is really important is cultural. What's going on in the country from a cultural perspective that could create problems for us in terms of people's conduct, whether it's kids running into town and getting alcohol or perhaps wearing piercings or whatever it is in that culture that you should be aware of. When you brief your students or your participants about the inherent and other risks or the current geopolitical issues in the country, what about the culture? Talk about that and what, you know, what it means if they conduct themselves in a way that in the U.S. might not even get a glance and in another country might be really a serious problem for them. And don't forget, even though you may be overseeing this group of people, whether they're minors or adults, you know, in your oversight position, that is going to create some duties. But you also have the opportunity, as Rod was saying, to craft words. You can craft words to say whatever you want to them, whether it's rules, whether it is their personal responsibility around their free time, the responsibility in terms of the inherent and other risks, and importantly, in the case of Hotchkiss, their duties, even though you, of course, are looking at the CDC periodically, want to know what's going on, you're going to debrief them on that, as you mentioned in your nice summary, you want to let them know that you expect them to be looking on those sites as well for their own. And of course, if they're doing STEP, they're getting that feedback. That's something they're doing separately from you. If they're choosing, what are they choosing they're going to do in terms of a shot or, you know, whatever, they're going to go somewhere and you go on the CDC website, there's like, okay, if you're a healthy person, you can do this. If you're sort of in the middle somewhere, you can't tell them what to do. They need to decide. You need to decide if you're going to go to a travel doctor, what you're going to do, because your health profile is your own. We can't make that decision for you. We can give you stats and all of that. So giving them personal responsibility and writing that into, as Rod will say, into your participant agreement that includes a release of liability, et cetera, so that they understand what they've got going in. Psychologically, they have chosen to come. They have responsibilities. I could go on, but that's a good beginning overview. Anyone else?
Yeah, and if you guys have questions anytime, just raise your hand. We can stop and address that and stuff. So please feel free to answer or ask any questions. Before passing on to Leah, I wanted to reinforce a couple of things. You know, in the safety management plan that we work with, we don't necessarily include the medical forms or the medical information, but we certainly do collect that information. We have a 2-page medical form that asks lots of questions. That's part of our screening process of our leaders. And as Rod was saying, who needs that information? It's the leader in the field. So the leader has that medical form. We actually recommend our leaders make a copy of that form and give it to the participant to carry on their person in case the leader falls off a cliff in their backpack or their backpack goes away and all the medical information goes with it, because the leader is going to have all that. So we actually have two sets of it, one for the participant, one for the leader. We don't have that in the office. I don't need that medical information. It's not going to be necessary. We do collect that at the end of the trip, so we keep that along with the liability waiver for 6.5 years, statute of limitations in California, in case there's a lawsuit and we need to pull out that information of what the participant shared with us if it's relevant to the case. So the real point is that really the medical information needs to be with the person and the leader. If the person goes on a chopper ride, that the medical personnel are going to want that medical form to take to the hospital so that they have all that information. So those are kind of some key points in that. The other thing, yes?
I always give my tour director the actual copy that was filled out by the participant, because they're, in the event there's an omission, it's not because I didn't enter that data into something online. It's their omission, and also handwriting can be sort of an issue. So if there's anything that needs to be clarified, you can have it. You can bring it up with the participant. Great. Sorry.
That's a very good point, because when somebody in-house is transcribing the medical information and they get the prescription wrong or they get the disease wrong, that can be an absolute disaster.
In the past, we've had attorneys who have said too much information can be dangerous. None of us are doctors. None of our DMCs usually have a doctor on staff. So I don't know what detail that you're asking for information, everybody, but you can misread the handwriting, the prescription, the combination of those drugs, versus the general question, are you capable of going on this itinerary? I'm curious what both attorneys think of asking for too much information that neither your staff nor your DMC has the ability to decipher. Only a medical doctor has the ability to decipher that, and then to have that information readily available. I mean, are there two thoughts on this, asking for too much?
Because we have so many hats in the room, I'm going to make this pretty general, so just take it in the way that is appropriate for you or ask us questions. But when I'm looking at medical forms, and I've done this for so many years, I'm not a doctor, right? I'm a lawyer. But what I'm looking at it, when I look at someone's medical form, I'm looking with my own lens. And again, it's a combination of practical, legal, and what I call information exchange, okay? So what is it you're asking, and why are you asking it? And as Rod clearly said, in the old days, 25 years ago when I started doing this, one of the attorneys in this office I was in of this big law firm said, the old adage has been, don't ask, because if you ask, it's going to increase your liability. And then I began to think, as I started to consult with these programs, going out into the field, away from definitive care, et cetera, wait a second. If I've just had brain surgery and I'm going into the field, into this remote area, wouldn't that be kind of an important thing for the field person to know? Because there might be some reaction in the field, and all of a sudden, which this has all happened, of course, and they come to find out this guy from Canada had brain surgery 6 months before, and that's why he was reacting in the field. People in Alaska didn't know. The Boston office didn't tell them that it was on the medical form. So the point is, it is true. Don't ask for so much information that it doesn't matter. But if you're going to ask the information, it could be important. Think about what you want to ask and why you need it. And then make sure that when you get it, you give it to the people that need to know and they actually do something with it. So if it's information that can't be deciphered, perhaps there needs to be a call made to that person to clarify what it is that they're saying in here so that we understand what it is. And perhaps the program then needs a medical consultant to help them figure out, okay, what do we have going on here? Is this something we need to be having a conversation about, or perhaps talking, with the getting permission to talk to the physician, that sort of thing. The other thing I do in the medical form, actually, is that I like to include, and again, this depends on who you are and how you do this, but If it's my client that's taking doing a tripping program in Africa and they ask these questions, I have the participant sign off on that, and I include a variety of language at the end, tying it back into the participant agreement that this is, you know, part of your agreement. You agreed to, you know, release us from liability. You need to understand that although we're gathering this information, we cannot anticipate or you know, we do not know. This is a risk of the combination of your health profile with your activities on the program. You know, we can't anticipate, you know, the injury, but we you know. So ways to kind of frame why you're asking it and what you're doing, and that you're not guaranteeing their safety simply because you're asking the information. Because sometimes people think, oh, well, they asked this information, so that this must be okay. They must be clearing me. And if you're going to ask for a doctor to look at them, a doctor's review, whatever, have them go into a doctor and get a sign-off, the doctor can say that. But on the program, for you to say, okay, we've cleared you to go, to me, that's kind of a dangerous road.
Yeah, let me just go back to John's point for just a second. Here's an example of what I think you want. You're doing a Kilimanjaro hike. I think it's reasonable and probably prudent, in addition to asking the general question, is there anything we ought to know about your ability to do this trip? Have you ever experienced high altitude sickness? That's important. Because that can happen. I mean, people have died on Kilimanjaro. And of course, a lot of people haven't died, but they haven't made it to the summit either because of altitude. So that's something that's particularly germane to that trip. If you're going somewhere where the evacuation potential is limited or very slow, Antarctica, probably the Galapagos. I mean, you can pick other places as well. You might point that out to them and ask a question directly relevant to that. But by far, I mean, light years ahead of anything else in importance, as Catherine said, get it to the source, get it to the leaders. It does you no good to keep it in the office back home.
Yeah, John, just one more thing on that. My leaders aren't doctors either, by all means, and we do get that information. A lot of times I tell them, go ask the person about their medications and why they're taking it and get some information from the person who's actually providing that. In some cases, we may need to go to a doctor. But again, it's really critical, whether or not that's relevant to the screening, it's critical to have that in the field in case they do get evacuated and they need that at the hospital. So that's kind of where that information comes in, not necessarily for screening them on or off the trip, but just to have that information in case something does come up. Does that address kind of what you were looking at?
Describe to the doctor in detail the itinerary, and then we don't ask the question. We say, "Could you approve?" We don't say, "Did you have past altitude sickness? Do you have a brain aneurysm?" We don't ask that. We just say to the doctor, "Do you feel that this person, you know, sign off?" Because we feel that the doctor must have this patient's medical history, and we can't know every question to answer. So we give a detailed description of where they're going and the altitudes, and then have the physician sign off of it. But I don't know what kind of questions, Tony, you're asking, but our questions are very general. And that was what by our legal counsel, so.
I think one of the issues that sounds like they may be concerned about is the Americans with Disabilities Act, in terms of if that would even apply going overseas, which is kind of but the idea of how much can you ask, I don't know if that's an issue that is being grappled with. But some people don't ask. Some people just have them go to a doctor. Some people don't have them go to a doctor and just ask, have a self-disclosure. There's a lot of different ways of doing this. And I mean, some of them may be better than others for you, but I think getting back to the idea that whatever it is you do, it needs to get to the source. If there are questions about it, it's important to be able to talk with the participant, perhaps even have your consulting physician get permission to talk with their doctor or whatever needs to happen in order to be clear on what you've got going into the field and that sort of thing.
We don't have a consulting physician. We have their doctor who should have intimate knowledge sign up.
Right.
So what we always ask at minimum is current medications, current medical conditions, because we've actually had cases where, I mean, we have World War II veterans that still travel with us and they're in their 90s. And you can't collect no information and still consider yourself responsible, in my opinion. So we ask for current medication, current medical conditions, because when that person passes out in the middle of the Jewish cemetery and they have to be taken by ambulance to the hospital and they are not conscious, we need something to show the doctor to say, so the doctor knows this is the medications that they are on and this is their current health condition, so the doctors have some place to start in order to start helping this person instead of starting from scratch, from point zero, they're at least starting from point 20. So we always ask those questions, and we do have a clause. I'm not sure if it's sufficient, which is why I'm here. We have a clause that specifically says we're asking you this information in order to use it in case of an emergency. Again, that's why I'm here. I don't know if that's sufficient, but we do add that. And we do keep it sealed until a such time that it needs to be used.
And you have it in the field.
Yes.
It's interesting that colloquy, because you're talking about legal requirements. You're talking about, don't we have an obligation apart from the law? If we can save somebody's life, shouldn't we get this minimal information so we can do it? And I think you're both right. I think legally, with very few exceptions, you don't have to ask for much. I think you can get by with, is there anything we ought to know about your mental or physical health that may impact your ability to do this trip? I don't know of a case where a tour operator has lost because that's all it asked. On the other hand, are you allergic to any medicines? Do you have any allergies? Well, the only downside is that if they tell you what the allergies are and they tell you what the medicines are that they're allergic to, you absolutely have to make sure that the people on the ground know it and give it to doctors if and as necessary.
I know we have lots of questions here and we're getting sort of sidetracked on medical, so we're going to...
Yeah, both medical and physical. But it's not unusual that people aren't truthful with us. And if you ask a specific question, are there any medical, any mental or physical reasons why you can't do this trip, they're not going to say, well, I'm under psychiatric care, and they don't want to be disqualified. If they don't tell us, my assumption is, then it's not going to be our liability, but should we add a clause that says, if you do not disclose this to us, we are not liable?
Well, that's the other part of what I include. Not exactly in those words, but I address the issue of failure to disclose or actually lying, which happens a lot, especially I see it with minors all the time. I'm sure Rod does too. So that's why I like to include information in the medical form to frame what we're asking, why we're asking it, and what we're not responsible for. So people know that to begin with, right? We all know, they're not stupid. But when something bad happens, they're gonna go to the other side if you haven't laid it out properly.
Last year we actually had somebody show up in a wheelchair that hadn't told us about it.
Well, that's, let me, I'm sorry, forgive me. I actually have that same case. That's exactly what happened. Look, if they answer no to the question about can you do all the activities, we can put in something that if you don't give us full, complete information, we have the right to throw you off the trip. But you already have a clause in there that if you can't do this, if you're an undue strain on the trip as a whole, we can toss you off. But once they say there's nothing wrong with them, legally, maybe not morally, legally, basically that gets you off the hook.
I know we're gonna. This isn't a medical session. We're all gonna be around. But let me just say another thing, because I've done a lot of work on this Americans with Disabilities Act, simply because the programs I deal with are concerned about it because they're already offering programs with risk, and then you're gonna add another layer. One thing I think that can be really productive, and I don't know about all of you, but is whether or not the ADA applies to you. You can develop a list of what is called essential eligibility criteria, or the essential functions, cognitive, physical, of what is required to go on this trip. And that can be available for anybody looking at your website, whether or not they even choose to apply. And so that way, hopefully coming in the door, they're like, oh, okay. And that's already a conversation, that those are things that, I mean, that's what you need to be able to do to get to do this trip. And so that may be something to look into to help you with this whole set of, and it feeds into whatever medical information you're asking. But I think it's a really practical thing to consider.
I just had one extra point. Something that we do, we're a ground operator, and we work in some very remote places. You know, it might be 4 hours before you can get to even basic medical care. So we always say that when we're gathering medical forms, we state at the top of the form, you're going to be in remote places. Healthcare is not what you're used to, and we need this information. And that, I think, can get people a bit more comfortable in giving you that information, because they're sort of thinking, oh, you know, if something does happen, you know, I want them to have this. So we always add that information.
I was going to have Aaliyah just talk a little about her safety management planning process, and then we can jump back into some questions here.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to pass around, it's a two-page, well, back and front, so it's three. I made 15 copies. It's probably not quite enough to go around. I wasn't sure how many to make. But I wanted to make a couple comments about the medical issues first. What we have in our office, as I said, we do study abroad, is really a 30, 40-page manual of many things. This is a real condensed version of some key points that we take care of pre-departure, at on-site orientation, in the event of a crisis, so that it's very broad to help you gauge what you're doing. As far as medical, we do have a medical form back in front. Students fill it out online, so we do print them, but we can also access it online, and we don't have to use it unless in the case of emergency. But I will tell you a couple of things that are important. We do ask what medications they're on. For example, in Japan, there are medicines that are not allowed in the country. We have had students disclose they're taking medicine X, and we've had to say, you will not be allowed to bring that into Japan. You need to talk to your doctor about what medicine could possibly substitute. We've had students that disclose they're going through gender change, and at certain points, it's a lot of medication. Again, we say, well, would you go talk to your doctor and make sure you're cleared to travel because of all the things that you'll be doing? And you know, we don't normally ask that students get clearance from doctors, but in certain cases we will, just to make sure. And again, if there's medication we think might be a problem bringing into a country. We tell students every time, all the time, do not ship your medicine. Bring what you need with you. And then someone will show up, oh, I only have a week's worth, I need the rest. And medicine can get shipped and held up in customs, they never even get it. I mean, so there's a reason to talk about medical issues beyond just, are they fit for the trip? And we've accounted all of these things. In the years that I've been doing this, I mean, we've encountered everything from, you know, sexual assault and rape. We've had several deaths. We've had students in the hospital with meningitis, students who've broken their back, broken jaws, many different things that we've dealt with over the years. We've expel students from the program for drugs, for bad conduct. So again, we haven't. 30 years, Michelle. Lot goes on. Yeah. Well, of the deaths, one was a senior citizen on one of our trips, one was a young student, and one was a faculty member over the years. Yes. 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 Yeah. So anyway, that's a little point about the medical issues. And yes, it's true. Students don't always disclose it truthfully. Sometimes the parents fill it out, and I wish they wouldn't. And we have students show up who immediately feel stressed out. They have anxiety. We've had students go home the first day or the first day after they arrive with panic attacks. Can't be there any longer. They immediately fly home. Or the parents will tell us, can you please get them counseling? We want them to stay, but just find a counselor for them. And, you know, that's tough, too. So, anyway, what you're looking at, though, is, as I said, sort of a there's back and front on the first page and a third page checklist of things that we do. So I kind of tried to put it in bunches. And legal issues and liability, you do need to understand the in-country laws and be able to communicate that well to your participants. Again, we're working with students, but they should know what the penalties are. The U.S. State Department won't bail someone out of jail. So you need to know the immigration regulations. In our case, we also need to know if there are incidents abroad that need to be reported back for the Clery Act. And Title IX can also apply. I think it might be a little bit up in the air as to, it's like ADA. There's a little gray area. But still, yes, we're cognizant of all that. So you need to be, you know, in our operation, we're the planners and the providers, okay? So we check the housing and make sure it is reputable, it's, I mean, everything. Modes of transportation, and look at all of that. We do have a liability waiver for our participants. We have a separate waiver for companions that may come along. We also ask them to sign a conduct contract. We've started that. We've told them for years what to do, and we enforce it pretty strongly on our programs, but we just have to keep reminding them. So we collect all this medical information, and it is available to all of our staff in the field. On our largest program in Innsbruck, we have a nurse as part of the staff, and she has office hours. She sees students all the time, but the hospital is about two blocks away. Yes. Yes, that's correct. It is a little bit different. We'll take our students to universities abroad, and we'll bring faculty from the U.S., hire faculty from abroad, and hold the program. But we have all the access to the medical records, and there's a hospital, for example, in Innsbruck that the students can go to. But it is critical to have this in a crisis. And we've gotten permission from the students to contact their parents or guardians for emergencies. And we have, and we will. We also register students with the STEP program before we go. We have contacts with the State Department. The last couple of years, we've actually brought in a gentleman who was the head of the Tri-Mission Security in Vienna for our program in Austria, for all the three U.S. missions, and he gave a talk on security to our students. It was really good, and we're going to try and do that again. So, you know, we're trying to also respond to what we perceive as the threats, increased threats of terrorism, and how to prepare our students for anti-Americanism, how to deal with that, what to do if they're confronted with something that's volatile when they're traveling, and as well as, as you mentioned, the cultural aspects of the countries we're in and what's accepted and what's not and how they can act in a way that is not perceived as contrary to those norms. There's a lot on these sheets as you read through it. I'm happy to talk about it more, but I'm not sure where we want the conversation to go right now. We do a lot pre-departure. We do it again on site. And then we have operating procedures for crises. You know, to me, one of the most important things is that you have well-trained professionals running the program. you think about what's in the best interest of the student and the program when you make decisions. I mean, no one can fault you for that when you're making decisions at the moment that are in the best interest of how to move forward and get through whatever the situation is. So,
Rob, want to address
it? Just 10 seconds. ADA, it does not apply overseas, period. Title IX, generally, Title IX does not apply overseas. However, there's a particularly venal case that involved a program in Cape Town, which was run by the university. It wasn't outsourced. It was what you do. And the court there in error said that Title IX does apply. So Title IX may apply, but the ADA does not.
Sorry. I just want to say, and that's good to hear, but what I was going to say is from a practical perspective, as Rod has mentioned earlier with the wheelchair showing up on the program, I mean, if they show up and they can't participate, it's nice to try and get some information ahead of time to know before they reach the front gate that actually they can't come. So if you can have, even if the ADA doesn't apply, to have an idea to understand that actually the people applying can come and participate is an important thing. And that this idea of EEC, and you don't have to call them that, but actually including something on your website to say, here's what you need to be able to do, and we get our direction from the ADA, but that helps you, from a practical perspective, run your program and not make people angry when they show up at the gate in a wheelchair and you're like, sorry, you can't go. The other thing I think I wanted to say is, I love this little summary she's put together. It covers a lot of the things I was going to talk about too, but be thinking about, and this came up in our session yesterday, this person that is getting this emergency, this safety management plan put together, that they really get it. Like, what is going to happen? We had a guy that was from an evacuation company yesterday speak up and say, call us ahead of time and we'll tell you what's going to come down if an emergency occurs. So you've got that front loading on all that information. If you use Global Guardian, International SOS, Trippish Insurance, whatever you've got, understand how they're going to react. Give them a call ahead of time. Know what that's going to look like. If you have a staff on program that's going to be taken out, that is, they may become the family relations manager, like the woman yesterday who was on program. Do you have enough staff to carry on the program? What's going to happen? Are you going to bring somebody down from your organization? Those things could be pre-thought out in such a way that it becomes this live thing that you really get when you're the person with it. It's not just a list. So I just wanted to raise that.
One more thing. And that's another point. We have travel insurance that's included with all of the program cost, and we work very closely with our insurance agent. We have for years, and I call his cell phone day and night to tell him if there's something going on, and he has always been there for us, and that's really important. And a student, you know, we talked about evacuation yesterday. We had a student who was raped, and because of the situation and all the factors, she did not want to go back to the police. When she went initially, it was a very bad experience. She just wanted to go home. And so he said, okay. He put her on the next flight. He said, that's good enough for me. You know, there wasn't any more invasion of her privacy at that point. It was, I'm unhappy. I already feel violated enough. All right, get her out of there. And that's really important. And we've had students evacuated from medical, like the one with meningitis and so forth. But I think that's really key, to have a very strong relationship with your insurance agent that you feel comfortable. And we've called him before when we saw things that might turn into something and gave him a heads up about hospital bills and things that were going to be happening. So,
yeah, and kind of reeling back to the safety management plan, as Aaliyah's got a lot of great information on here, that's even delving into more of your comprehensive risk management system. And if you look at what that was, we did that last year and presented on that your comprehensive system is all of these different components, all these different things. The safety management plan is just one little piece of that you're doing, because you've got all these other things, your medical forms, your evacuation insurance, your legal stuff, and all the other steps in there about how you respond to crisis and all those kind of things make up your whole system and looking at that. So it's sometimes helpful to have an analysis done of your whole system and how does your system operate and where you might have some holes in your system or where you might be a little outdated. You know, we have a waiver that we have a one-page waiver for that was developed 15 years, 20 years ago. Clearly that's out of date and we're in the process of revising that. So, you know, not only doing it once, but kind of coming back to it and looking at that, evaluating it. Certainly after incidents, I talked a little about that yesterday. You know, if there's a significant incident, we do a complete investigation of that incident, lessons learned, programmatic changes to fold those that information back into our own program so that we can take that and learn. And if anything ever comes up, we can demonstrate to the court or to whoever needs to know that saying, hey, we did have an incident and we made proper changes and now we've implemented those changes, like I talked about yesterday with the safety whistles that we now hand out to all of our participants because of our lost hiker that we had. So just kind of thinking about that, you know, the form I put out here with the safety management plan is just one little piece of that, but thinking about how that integrates into your whole safety management or comprehensive risk management system as a whole for that. We're getting close on time. Are there specific questions people have about other things that we've talked about? I know there may have been a couple hands.
I just want to ask people in the group about their experiences and how they've dealt with early onset dementia, which seems to be on the upswing.
Big question.
So we've had that come up a few times. They didn't put it on their form, so it was kind of like discussions with our guest services team. But we ask them to bring a companion with them. So a lot of times they'll bring a daughter or a son or make sure their husband and wife is with them. And that's worked out pretty well. We don't want people getting lost. That's also happened before, too. So.
Yeah, I don't know if there's specific strategies out there to deal with it other than being aware of it. Having those conversations ahead of time so that you can know as part of your screening process. Right.
And they may not know.
Yeah. Right. One of the things we expect our leaders to do is have conversations with participants. You know, they have the form, they have the information submitted, and start asking questions. You know, is it a yellow flag that they might get raised? Is it a red flag? You know, maybe it's a way to find out if they're not being truthful about certain things. So having that one-on-one discussion by phone, not just with the spouse, but with both, you know, the husband and wife, because sometimes the husband or wife may misrepresent the other. Sometimes I've seen it where they're dragging the person along on the trip that they didn't really want to go on. So those kind of things come up. So we do recommend individual conversations so that we can, you know, flush some of that out, probe a little bit deeper, and then maybe say, hey, you need to take this to your doctor and really get them to sign off on it now because I still have some concerns and I want to make sure they're doing that. So those kind of things can help flush out some of that sometimes, certainly not always. And then maybe medications that might be on that might kind of help indicate some of that might be going on behind the scenes that you might not know about. But there's always surprises, definitely, and, you know, people lying, not being truthful and things like that that they show up with that you're not prepared for. And we have turned people away at the gate, at the trailhead in a foreign country where sent them home because it wasn't appropriate type thing. Other questions people have, specifics, other comments from...
And Tony did a pretty good job on this, but I just wanted to follow up. Think about when you're looking at these safety management plans, the really one key thing is if you have a serious incident, or including a death, that it is going to knit back into or weave into the overall crisis response plan of, let's say, the university back home, right? So if you've got your incident response on the ground that you're briefed on and all that, but with social media, et cetera, you know, those guys back home may find out about this through some communication on a cell phone, right? And that's happened before many times. And so you just need to know, like, how is this going to knit back in? What do I need to do to reach out to home? And how are they going to come into play? Who's going to be in charge of family relations or communications or managing social media and the media? And who's the spokesperson? That you understand that you're one, that piece that's on the ground, and it's going to knit back in, and you want that to happen in the way that it should. So that's my...
We're just about out of time, so final closing thoughts. Did you have anything else, Celia, you want to comment on?
Just that I hope the handout's helpful to you and is a good overall summary. It's, you know, it's a lot of responsibility There's no doubt. But I think it can be managed if with the preparation and the planning, you can manage this so that when crises hit, you don't feel so lost. And there are a lot of resources out there. So feel free if you want to email me or follow up later. I'm happy to help.
Yeah, thank you. Certainly all of us will be available after or later on. If you guys have questions, come up to us, talk to us, ask us anything you like or, you know, certainly information. I want to thank Leah. Oh, did you have
a... Can I have a quick question? For those of us that do alumni travel program planning, and for a traditional trip, working with one of the operators, such as Alumni Holidays, who use ground operators, and it's maybe a European river cruise, how familiar should we be with their safety management plan? How would you respond?
Great question. So who's going to get the call, right? Are you going to get that call about somebody dying? Is it your tour operator? You know, and who's going to manage that? And I think that's going to be something you're going to want to sit down with your tour operator and say, how's this going to work? Is it going to be me getting a call? Are we going to be the incident response team? And I think having that discussion. So whoever's going to be responsible or involved in that response needs to have that safety management plan. So
can I just address that? There was a cruise years ago with a company that no longer exists. And somebody died on the trip. And they expected... There were several alumni associations on the trip, and they expected the operator or the cruise line to manage the repatriation. You know, help the wife out, the widow, all of that. They expected that the operator and the cruise line would do that. They did not. And this, the particular school that the person was traveling with did not have a host. So the two hosts from two other schools were the ones that helped the wife, helped her get home, figured out how to deal with the body, and got everything taken care of. So I think as an operator, ask. I'm more than happy to talk about what we do and how we would manage stuff like that. And in all frankness, if they're not willing to tell you how they're going to handle that, I wouldn't do business with them. As a former planner, I wouldn't do business with them.
One last thing from Ron. It's going to be real quick.
Yeah. To Margaret. No good tour operator does not have an emergency plan on what to do when a disaster happens. It's an absolutely legitimate question to ask. And as you said, if you don't get an answer that you're happy with, go to a different tour operator. No, you don't need copies of it. You don't need to micromanage it. You have to be satisfied that they know what to do in an emergency.
And to be able to tell your host, this is what should happen if something happens. This is the person.
Great. Well, thank you all. Thanks, Kathy, Rod, Aaliyah, for doing this. And I do have a safety whistle for all of you if you want to take back with you, so I'm going to pass this around just so you can be safe.
Good.
It floats. You can run over with a car. It's a great whistle. We did a lot of research to get one of the best whistles out there. It's made in America, made by veterans. Whistles for life. It's really a great, great thing. So, yeah, no, it's... Yeah, it's...
That's the time to get rid of them, right?
That's right. Yeah, go for it. I had enough here, so... You betcha. Yeah, go ahead. There you go. All right, use it in good health. Thank you all.